appreciate Levi reading the text for us. You know, I found myself studying and going through this. You know, I don't know about you, but I felt sad. I felt maybe a little shameful, you know, to think that, you know, mankind put to death the Son of God. God allowed it to happen. It makes me feel sad to think what Jesus had to endure for a rebellious creature. Thankfully, Jesus was willing to be obedient to the Father's plans. We've got some amazing verses to consider here this evening. If I understand right, Bart gave the answer to the last question last Wednesday, so maybe we'll just pick up with Landon if you're okay with that. So here's our question. Why might the gospel accounts have spared the details of the scourging of Jesus? Why did the soldiers try to further humiliate Jesus with the crown of thorns and the purple robe? What significance should these particular events have on us? Verses 1 through 5, Landon.
So in our discussion that we had, we talked about, for this first question, that all of the gospels are basically void of emotion. We're talking about this. John gives the most description about this scene. And we talked about how amazing that is, that all the gospels are like this. And we were talking about it, and it might be slightly, you know, inappropriate to focus in on how much Jesus suffered, because it might just overshadow everything that he accomplished if you focus in too much on the pain that he was enduring. Even though that's important, it's important for us to understand how much he loved us and he died for us. It could have potentially overshadowed a lot of the amazing stuff that Jesus accomplished here. And so I think it's that's perhaps a reason why they left out some detail. For part B, why did the soldiers try to further humiliate Jesus with the crown of thorns? Well, I mean, they're stressed out. You know, the Jews are mobbing. They're wanting this guy to be put to death. And as we talked about last time, you know, it's Pilate's job. Dad said Pilate had two jobs: get the taxes and keep the peace. And so, you know, this is a very stressful moment for the Romans in the Judea, because, you know, it's 1.5 million Jews are coming into Jerusalem. There's a lot of people. It's hard to control the crowd, and so they're stressed out. And to add to that, this guy's claiming to be the king. He's claiming to be a king, and they don't really have any idea of who God is, and so, you know, they're taking offense to that. Maybe he's trying to take the place of Caesar, put himself above Caesar. And so that's also part of why they were humiliating him, Jesus, here. And for the third question, what significance should these particular events have on us? We weren't entirely sure what Austin was getting at here with this question. Dad said, he took the last verse where it says, and Pilate said to him, "Behold the man." And Dad said, we should behold the man ourselves and consider our submission to the king. And I also think, like I said before, it's important for us to understand how much suffering Jesus did have to go through during these events.
Very good, very good. I appreciate those answers very much. Anyone else have anything to add? Austin?
I fully agree with all of what Landon just said there. I would add the possibility, it may be kind of a shot in the dark, but also this is written to an audience that knew what scourging was. They knew what crucifixion was. Possibly had seen it performed on people that they knew and loved, and You know, it's not that John couldn't go into detail, because you look at the anointing of Mary, of Jesus, and it goes in kind of specific detail as to what she did. You know, she broke the alabaster box, and she wiped his feet with her hair. He went into detail with. But scourging and crucifixion, he doesn't go into detail in at all. Perhaps that's the reason, but I really agree with Landon. To go through the specific things misses the larger picture, which is what John actually gets at, which we'll study next week so that he might believe.
Yeah, I didn't think of that, the first part of this question. I didn't think about it the way Landon and the family talk about it. But I was kind of on that path thinking that those gruesome details didn't need to be included. And didn't know if, again, we're trying to reach a Jewish audience, and you know, how much guilt and blame are you going to heap on them to where maybe, you know, maybe enough said that, you know, they knew what scourging was, they knew what crucifixion was. Anyone else have anything to add here? I had a little bit of different take on the second part of this question. It seems to me like the soldiers were trying to further humiliate. It seems to me like they would have heard, this guy's a king. This guy's claiming to be a king. And okay, we're going to embarrass him and make a scene out of this. And it's the crown of thorns, the purple robe. And I can imagine the Jewish audience would have liked seeing the Roman guard making fun of Jesus. And maybe they got a little bit, you know, this wasn't your normal crucifixion. We're going to have some fun here. And you know, just that kind of mindset with these soldiers. Anything else? Question? Lauren?
Well, another thing you might think about is Jesus has endured all the worst the world had to offer. So here he endures religious persecution, but here he's enduring political persecution. So it's another type of persecution. Mm-hmm. So he's an example for all of us.
Mark? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've really said, Landon said this before, but you know, the Romans, they had a thing called the Roman triumph, and whenever you went overseas or into a different place in the world and you conquered another nation, you would bring back their leaders, and then you would parade them through the streets of Rome in chains, you know, people throw stuff at them. And so the Romans were, you know, this was something, if you said you were the king of the Germans, then they beat you, you know, then they would bring you back, parade you around, and then kill you. And so this, they're behaving the way they've been trained, to, you know, to be savage to people they've subdued.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good. Anyone else? Question number one.
Austin. Just a little something to add. Particularly when it comes to that last question there, I wasn't really looking for anything specific. But like you started out saying, how much sorrow these verses bring to us. There's a connection I actually made with the last lesson that Lauren gave. I think it was the last one, where he's talking about when the old men who had seen the first temple saw the second, or saw the foundation laid, they started crying, and the younger generation were shouting for joy, and you couldn't tell the difference between the cries and the shout for joy because of how loud it was. Kind of gave me an idea for a song, actually, because when you look at this particular account, this particular story, it's much the same way, because we can't help but feel sorrow and sorry, remorse, for, because it's not just these individuals. He went because of all of us. He went for us, and we receive so many blessings because of it. So there's obviously joy. We're thankful that he did, but sorrow at the same time. So that's just another connection.
Yeah. Yeah, and I had intended, as I was working on question number one, I happened to think of Psalm number 28, Dying for My King. And I thought, I've got to get somebody to lead that song. Well, I forgot. All right, anybody else? Question number one. Let's move on to question number two. We're probably going to need to keep going pretty quick. Question number two. Colton? Okay. Why did the Jews specifically request Jesus to be crucified? Why did they wait to tell Pilate the reason they wanted Jesus to die? Why did this make Pilate reconsider? So, any or all of them?
For the first part, there is a curse associated with hanging on a tree. It's found in Galatians chapter 3, verse 13. So the religious leaders would have thought that by having Jesus crucified, people wouldn't say that he was the Messiah, because the Messiah couldn't have been cursed. As for the second part, I think that they first gave the most convincing charge to Pilate, which is that he said he was a king, which was under Roman rule, that would have been a pretty large crime to disrespect Caesar by saying that you were the king. You were a king. As for the third part, why did this make Pilate reconsider? Just Jesus did not act like anyone Pilate had seen before. It's just everything Jesus has done up to this point is so contrary to what he's seen.
Mm-hmm. From victims.
Yeah. That he sees an innocence in him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even going like we studied, going back into chapter 18, Pilate sees right away this man's innocent, and he tried his best, but he didn't have much of a chance, did he? Anyone else? Question number two. Anything to add? Austin?
I'd add also, I agree exactly with what he said, but I'd add also that Pilate was a superstitious man.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pagan man, so
they believed in gods.
They believed in gods, and if someone says that he said he was the son of God, so we're going to kill him, to a pagan, that is, just what they did with Paul and Silas when they thought the gods had come down to us in the likeness of men. They ran out with garlands and they were ready to slaughter things to them just off of that brief interaction with them. So certainly that would make this Roman governor.
Yep. I think you're exactly right. Well, Cole, I like especially what you said on that first question. You know, crucifixion was one of the most, if not the most humiliating and cruel way to die. So of course the Jewish leaders would want that for Jesus. Just to do everything they can to stomp out his reputation. Anyone else? Question number two. I had as you pointed out, Austin, the Romans believed in gods. In fact, believed that they came to earth in human form and wreaked havoc from time to time. Pilate already knew Jesus was innocent and wasn't acting like those, and he wasn't acting like those typical victims or criminals. And also remember that Pilate's wife had sent him a note, Matthew 27, verse 19, about having nothing to do with this innocent man, that she'd suffered great things during the night. So there were quite a few different reasons that would have been in the background causing Pilate to have trouble with this situation. Anyone else? Question number two. All right, question number three, Levi, if you're up for it. What power had been given to Pilate? What might this tell us? Question number three. What power had been given to Pilate? What might this tell us about the relationship between those that hold authority on earth and God who gives the authority? What did Jesus mean by saying the one who delivered him had the greater sin? This is verses 9 through 11.
What power had been given to Pilate? I was kind of thinking more political power. Power to crucify Jesus, as it's talked about in the text. It also could just be power in general. The second question talks about political power, so I guess I'll talk about. I guess that's what I'm going to take for the first one, is basically political power. The second part, relationship between on earth and God and who gives the authority. My dad brought up, it's like the rulers are only in place because of the will of God. Our president is only in place because of the will of God, and any other worldly ruler is in place because of the will of God. And so I just like that. I like that it's adding to the ominousness of, I'm not sure if that's a word, but the ominousness of what Jesus has been saying to Pilate so far. where it's, you know, he's not acting like Cole is saying that, like anyone he's ever seen. He's saying these ominous things that, you know, you could have no power and must have been given to you from above. So I just like that he's insinuating certain things, you know. And then what did Jesus mean by saying the one that lived in had a greater sin? I think the Pharisees obviously were more condemned than Pilate was. We, in our culture today, you know, you sometimes see demonizing Pilate so much to where, you know, you put him on the same level as the Pharisees. But Pharisees had read the law. They knew Jesus. They truly did know that Jesus was the Messiah, but they just wanted to put him on the cross. I just think it's so interesting that even later in the chapter when they're saying to Pilate, we have no king but Caesar, they're forgetting their own law and asking a Roman to kill their own rabbi, lowest of the low here. And then Pilate, who doesn't know Jesus, hasn't studied the Torah, hasn't studied all the other books. He is just a man in doing politics, and he wants to do what's best for politics. And that's what he did. So that's why he has the Pharisees have a greater sin and all the people who put him in, all the Jews.
They had the witnesses from the past, didn't they? They knew a Messiah was coming. They had prophecies. They had things that they should have known better. Yeah. Very good, very good. Anyone else on question number three? Logan.
Just something quick to add, and try not to read too much into this, but it's amazing to note how much composure Jesus had in these moments.
Yeah.
In chapter 3, we studied, you know, he's in the garden and he's sweating drops of blood. The stress of that has to be immense. I doubt anyone here has had something like that happen to him. I think Wes gave a sermon on it. So it is a real condition that can happen to people. But it's extremely rare. So he's under that much stress, and at this moment in time, you know, the time has come. It's about to happen. He's, you know, it appears that he's calm, he's collected, and he's responding to Pilate these simple but profound answers. So the Lord is strengthening him here. He was a man, and he was under immense stress. So.
Right. Anyone else? Question number three. Wayne.
I just have a good verse for the same thing that I found through my study through James. And it's James 3, verse 1, where James writes, "My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment." So those who lead the congregation, those who have the knowledge, they will be judged stricter than those who don't have the knowledge. And it's just interesting.
Same principle. Yeah. The Jews knew better. Anyone else? Question number three. Laura?
Two verses from Pilate's authority. Daniel 2:21. "And he changes the times and seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding." And then Romans 13:1. "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by
him." Yeah, I was thinking of that Romans passage, but I wasn't sure if it was 13 or 14. Thank you. Chapter 13. Anyone else on question number three? We should also understand that those who have authority, those who are given authority on earth, are still going to have to answer to God on how they use that authority. So that's an important aspect. Pilate obviously was trying to do the right thing, but he didn't have the courage enough. He was working for peace, wasn't he? He didn't want to have an insurrection here and have leaders from Rome come in and have to take over. Okay. Nothing else on question number three? Let's look at question number four. Austin, if you're up for it. "Why did the Jews claim loyalty to Caesar despite their hatred of the Roman Empire and desire for independence? What might be some of the reasons why Pilate caved in to the Jews' demands?" It's verses 12 through 15.
You know, it's interesting. Their claim of loyalty to Caesar really stands as a last slap in the face to God. Because when God brought them out of Egypt and gave the law, he established a theocracy. God was their king. He was their ruler. He was their protector. And beyond that, that was their king. Of course, we know that that wasn't good enough. They said, give us a king like all the other nations. We want an actual king. We don't want you as our king, God. So he says, okay, I'll give you a king. This is the kind of king you're going to get. And they said, yeah, we're fine with however evil or whatever, just as long as we have a king. Of course, David comes along. He says, I'm going to set up a king that sits on the throne of David that's going to last forever. And we know that that's fulfilled in Jesus. And seemingly, another getting back to that theocracy where the kingship is embodied in God, once again, in the Son of God, in Jesus the Christ. And again, they say, no, we don't want that. We don't want the Messiah to be king over us. Give us Caesar instead. So it seems to me just one last slap in the face to God. And again, that's because of their absolute hatred of Jesus. They would rather, and I suppose this may be just a momentary thing just to get what they want, but it's telling. History is very telling because they rejected Jesus, and of course, God ultimately rejects the nation of Israel because of their rebelliousness. So they choose Caesar over the king, over the true king. It breaks your heart. But of course, from Pilate's standpoint, and I think I noticed this more than I had in times past, he is really in a pickle here. And when politically speaking, he does not have many options because of the type of people that the Jews are. They are not people that are easily swayed, or you can't give them anything. They will get whatever they want. And if they don't, they're going to start a riot. They've proven that time and time again. Going all the way back to... So anyway, he's in a particular predicament here. And he ends up... He knows that Jesus is innocent. But I think he gives him what he wants. Just simply because he doesn't see a way out. And I think probably providentially that's the case as well.
Part of it as well. Yeah. Anyone else on question number four, Bart?
Yeah, we've just recently read Psalm 2. Maybe it was last Lord's Day. But it's the psalm that says, why do the nations rage and the people plot vain things? They set themselves, the kings of the earth set themselves on the rulers, take counsel against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in heaven shall laugh, the Lord shall hold them in derision. Shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on the holy hill of Zion. I think Shah is going to address this psalm, but it seems to me to be a direct prophecy in this psalm of what we're reading about tonight. They try to take Jesus the king down, and instead God anoints him.
So. Very good. That's right. Anyone else for question number four? I found the Greek text...
check verse 15, when Pilate asked, shall I crucify your king? In my reading, one of the writers suggested that the Greek reads more like, your king, shall I crucify him? And part of it, in the reading, you know, I think part of this is Pilate trying anything he can to kind of get back. He's showing his scorn and he's insulting these Jews as best he can with this question. And the fury and the rage of the mob blinded them so much that the high priest claimed Caesar as their king. Under normal circumstances, they never do this. But again, as we I think it was Cole answering, they couldn't take these charges to Pilate saying that this man says he's the Son of God. They have to have civil violations to get Pilate to even hear the case. So as they stammered around and got all worked up in a frenzy over the civil charges, it gets out now.
because he claimed himself to be the Son of God. Anyone else on question number four? Yeah, and the situation had been going on for several hours now. And the pilot's probably sick of it. He's wanting this to get over and get out from in front of him so that he can go figure out what's the next step, I suppose. So this was a difficult time for Pilate, certainly. All right. Yeah, please.
I'll just throw in a verse here. I really liked Proverbs 26, verse 24, where it's really exactly what's happening here. It says, "He who hates disguises it with his lips and lays up deceit within himself. And when he speaks kindly, do not believe him. For there are seven abominations in his heart. Though his hatred is covered by deceit, his wickedness will be revealed before the assembly. Whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and whoever rolls a stone will have it roll back on him." And that's exactly what happened to the Jews. It took a few years, but Rome came back and destroyed them.
You know, to that point, Herod was disgraced and exiled. Pilate was disgraced and exiled. So all the people involved here, to your point, it's going to all roll back on them. Good verse. Thank you. Lance.
Add to Mark and Landon's verses. Psalm 76 is another good one, particularly verse 10. "So surely the wrath of man shall praise you. With the remainder of wrath you shall gird yourself." Just that whole chapter is, you know, kind of the same vein of things. So I remember right there. Yeah.
All right.
This is
question number five. Why did Jesus bear his own cross? Where might Golgotha have been located? Hunter, you'd like this.
Yep. All right, so in regards to the first question here, so I'm sure it's kind of a twofold, probably more than that, as far as to the why, as to where, why he bared his own cross, bore his own cross. I'm sure, first off, they probably told him to do so, and it was, you know, an explicit command that, you know, further punishment that you're going to carry this out, you know, on top of all the suffering that you've already went through and the scourging and your back's ripped open and just another insult to injury. But it also is a tremendous thematic play right here to for Jesus, who is willingly bearing this burden of all of mankind and all of sin, to willingly, to physically sort of manifest that in carrying his own cross up to, you know, on the Via Dolorosa, all the way up there to Calvary. So it's also, it's a good literal, it's a great, you know, I don't know, you know what I'm trying to say. But, you know, and also in the secular world, that this has become kind of a commonplace saying as well, you know, when someone has their own issues, you know, say take up your cross, bear your own burdens, you know, bear your own cross. So that is also at play here as far as the why, but certainly it's more of a thematic thing. And then where might Golgotha have been located? I'm sure you got some maps on the board there.
It's kind of fuzzy though.
Yeah. So
we're talking about, most believe, over in this area, but it's debated.
Right. So yeah, from what I was able to see, most the traditional view is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre there, and you know, it's kind of on the hill. Oh, there you go. And yep. And then the tomb is underneath a little bit. But yeah, and then there's also that skull place. I forget some garden. It's called a garden of some kind.
Yeah. So if we think about the roads and the possibility of being able to display this crucifixion event, the Romans would use this as a message to the rest of the nation, of the people. You better stay in line. So they would have had this in a visible spot. Now, again, we might have some discussion whether it's over here, or I think there was also some possibility of up here, but out in visible plain sight. And then I did think this other slide was pretty impressive. I saw a bunch of different pictures showing this place of the skull, This is obviously an old picture. Well, maybe not obviously, but I think this is an old picture because the other pictures I saw, they had it was like a whole tourist buses and places to turn around and drive up by below this outcropping, and it was kind of interesting. Anyone
information to add here on question number five. Mark?
One of the things we talk about is Genesis 22, when Abraham takes Isaac to this same location, Mount Moriah, and Isaac is seen by most commentators as a type of Christ, a young man, probably about the same age as Jesus, and Abraham's only son. God says to Abraham, take your son, your only son, and Isaac carries the wood of sacrifice. And so Abraham loads the wood of sacrifice on Isaac, and Isaac has to carry it up the mountain to his own possible sacrifice. So it's really what Hunter said. It's a biblical type and anti-type that's being fulfilled.
Yeah, and it was common practice for the one being crucified to bear their own cross, followed by four Roman soldiers. So there would have been a progression with, like, Christ, four Roman soldiers, one of the thieves, four more Roman soldiers, and it would have been a whole progression trying to make their way to Calvary is kind of what I was able to study and understand. Anyone else? Dakota.
Yeah, that was just something that came to mind is Matthew chapter 16, verse 24. Here Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he says, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. So here we even see a prophetic passage. You know, God later on foretells the actual crucifixion, but here I think this is already an allusion to something that, you know, Jesus Christ set the example for what we'll have to follow. And by following him, in a sense, we have to take up a cross in a figurative sense, and this kind of foretells that. It's just something that really bolsters faith, too, when you see passages like this, because it's really like, you know, God's playing chess and we're playing checkers, you know, we're trying to catch up as we read his word, and all these connections, and just things that exceed human-like wisdom, you know, dividing, I guess.
Yeah, very good. Good point. Lauren?
A little off topic, but Matthew 27:32 says Simon of Cyrene carried the cross, and Luke 23:26 says Simon bore the cross after Jesus. So there's some discussion in some of the commentators about what this is. So either Simon carried it when Jesus could carry it no longer, or some suggested that maybe Jesus carried one end and Simon followed him carrying the other end. I thought was kind of interesting. The bearing it after Jesus.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Following behind. Yeah. Trying to help. Anyone else?
Awesome. I've also heard it said, I don't know, this, like everything, it's up for debate, but as far as him bearing his cross, there have been some that have suggested that this was not the entire cross, but just a cross beam.
Yeah.
Because of the weight of an actual cross would be, you know, a couple hundred pounds probably all put together. That this was probably just a portion of the cross, particularly him having been scourged, the weight of that being the cross beam that he would be under. That's up for debate. Another passage to add, as far as this fulfilling some things, would be Hebrews chapter 13, verse 11. It says, for the bodies, those animals whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin, are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. So I think there's some symbolism there.
Yeah, very good. Anyone else? Question number five. All right, let's look at question number six. Why did Pilate write the title over Jesus that he did? Why did the Jews want the title changed? Yes?
Well, my first reaction to that, first part of this is in light of Pilate's actions in verse 8, said after he heard that he made himself to be the Son of God, he was more afraid. And down to verse 12, from then on, Pilate sought to release him. He was really trying to let this man go. Of course, his wife, you know, mm-hmm. had nothing to do. And I think another account, which one of the Gospel is, how, why, what is it, what evil has he done or something? So he's really trying to do this. So my answer, the first part of the answer is I think that may have been Pilate's way of acknowledging Jesus with kingship. And I don't know. Anyway, also to go along with that, it was customary for the condemned prisoner to have his name on sign and the crime for what he had done. And I think in this case, the sign was probably meant to be ironic in a sense that for people passing by in a high traffic area, here's a Jewish king stripped, executed in public view, a king who had obviously lost his kingship from all outward appearances. But the truth of the matter, Jesus was just coming into his kingdom. And his death would be the death blow for Satan's rule in this world, and would establish, of course, establish Jesus' eternal authority over all the earth. And the sign was absolutely true. Jesus is the king of the Jews and the Gentiles also forever and ever. So second part of this, why did the Jews want this title changed? Pretty obvious. The Jews wanted it changed because this was the very, according to them, the blasphemous account of why Jesus, they wanted to kill, according to them. And Jesus, you know, got him in trouble in the first place. And here it is, blasted for everybody to see that Jesus is he is a king. The statement. Jesus, you know, the true statement. And so now they're going, what?
Right.
Change it.
Yeah, no. Yeah, irony of the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah, anyone else? Question number six. I kind of went with that first part of the question. I think that Pilate was continuing to try to insult the Jewish leadership. They backed Pilate into a corner, and this was like the only retaliation he could have was to insult him. And Pilate saw how furious it had made them previously, back in verses 14 and 15. Oh, and for good measure, we're going to do this in three languages, so everybody will understand. And again, the irony is he really was the king of the Jews. And I found that the Jews wanted it to change because they didn't want people to be able to read King of the Jews. You know, they wanted to get Jesus as far away from them as they could. They've got him killed. They've got him killed. They're going to get him killed here shortly. And now, let's just get as far away from him as we can, as quick as we can. Anyone else on question number six? Austin.
Quick thing to add. McGarvey mentioned, as far as the three languages, says these three languages were respectively those of religion, law, and philosophy. The Pilate made use of them because all three were spoken by people then in Jerusalem. So if that's the case, if that's the reason why those three were chosen, then again, it's proof, ironically, like Dennis was talking about, Jesus is the fulfillment of religion, law, and all philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good. Anything else? Appreciate everyone's participation. Great material to be considered, and it'll be interesting as we continue to work our way through this chapter.